Good morning, Chair. My name is Delphine Sirumaga. I'm actually the Executive Director for the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation. This submission was actually a joint submission with the Center for Applied Legal Studies and CSVR. The adjustments that have been made, as I don't want to duplicate what we've been speaking about throughout the morning. However, CALS and CSVR, we do commend the Ministry and her department and the initiative to address the ever-present issue of gender discrimination and the need for women's empowerment through the efforts being made at this present stage. At the same time, we do commend the responses through the preparations and the submissions of the combined second, third, and fourth periodic reports of the government of South Africa and measures adopted to implement CEDAW and the constructive engagement with the committee, the CEDAW committee. And this submission was made February 2011. And this is where our basis will be around CSVR and CAL's response, because we're going to take from the issue of the response to the CEDAW's observations, the concluding observations, and put this against this current bill in question. We do acknowledge that as part of the concluding observations, there was the issue raised. Sorry?
Can I just ask these posters to be put back because they are distracting the public hearing? If you don't want to be removed forcefully, can I ask you to lay down your this? They are disturbing, they are disrupting the public hearings. You are not allowed to come in here to come and do that. Otherwise, had we known, you could not be allowed. You would not have been allowed to come in here. Can you lay down these posters? Can you proceed?
Thank you. Okay. As I was saying, our basis is going to be around the CEDAW committee's concluding observations and the relationship with this particular bill. One of the strong recommendations which we believe this bill stems from comes from the principle of
Member Lamont, Chair, thank you. Can we do justice to all the presenters? All the other presenters did not do their submissions under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Can we please have order or discipline in this room? And if this is the way we ought to go, can we have it from you, please?
I don't think this is the right way to go because they also presented. That is why I requested that they put their posters down, and if they don't do that, they'll be removed forcefully by the security. So the security is coming. But in the meantime, we'll proceed. Because we think... Can I?
Can we adjourn for 5 minutes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for your patience. Can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to try and pick up from the point of we were recognizing that in response to the CEDAW Committee's concluding observations, where it was expressed that national legislation does not embody the principle of substantive equality between men and women, the committee urged the government to speedily draft a gender equality bill. And that we acknowledge. However, we would like to bring attention to the additional areas of critical concern that were raised at the concluding, within the concluding observations that are respectfully directly related to our concerns with this particular bill. Of the concluding observations, there were six that were raised and do resonate with us. So the first one is the persistent obstacles in the advancement of women and the lack of representation in decision-making. The second being the disadvantaged position of women in rural and remote areas. And these two areas have already really been spoken about. Our arguments are similar, but they might have a little bit of a difference in what we are saying. The third being the fact that harmful customary and traditional practices have adverse impact on women's empowerment of the rights guaranteed under CEDAW and also under the South African Constitution. The high levels of sexual and domestic violence against women and girls seemingly perpetuated with impunity when considering the low rates of prosecution and convictions for these crimes. Second last is that the certain provisions of the traditional courts bill may jeopardize women's access to justice and equality of treatment between before the law. And lastly, the major obstacle to the goal of achieving women's empowerment and the gender equality. The persistence of patriarchy, which to us is a big point, the issue of patriarchy, and the deep root stereotypes, which also are embodied within patriarchy. The roles and responsibilities that discriminate against women, and that would address, when I go forward, address the issue of 50-50, and the inadequate implementation of effective and comprehensive measures to modify or eliminate stereotypes and negative traditional values. So again, our big points are the implementation issue, roles, responsibilities, and the issue around patriarchal attitudes that do exist. CSVR and CALS did submit a written submission. However, we would like to highlight the salient points within that and probably introduce some more issues to the table. The consultation part of the issue, we recognize the efforts of the ministry to widen its consultation. However, in relation to the representation and decision-making processes, thus the participation of women in this process and the policy formation, which actually is part of the principles of CEDAW, the Maputo Protocol, which is not mentioned in this bill, and the South African Constitution, it raises concern for the lack of adequate notice and the adequate notice or time for full engagement in this. And I'm not talking about engagement of civil societies that are already organized, but also the consultation processes that would have made a bigger difference if we could mobilize our beneficiaries or our target groups to have a more substantive approach to the bill. And the next one is about duplication versus addressing the core problems that need to be addressed within South Africa. Now, considering the comprehensive legislative framework in South Africa, we are concerned that this bill tends to reinforce provisions already set out in law, and it has been mentioned already, around the Employment Equity Act of 98 and the Promotion of Equal and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination of 2000 Act. And this as opposed to the concentrating resources on closing the gaps of inadequate implementation of effective and comprehensive measures, therefore missing the opportunity that really truly exists, and that is the addressing the core of implementation and gap closing. And this would have been direct response to the issues that were raised by CEDAW in their concluding observations. The second one is about quota systems. The development of a bill that introduces a quota system is at risk of providing limited commitment to real substantive equality transformation. And by that I mean, if we did meet the quotas, the question would then be, what roles are the women given to play or allowed to play within these structures, and what tends to happen, considering the opening remarks of the chairperson in the limited amount of women who do engage in high-level decision-making processes, and furthermore, also at local-level processes where they are traditional structures as well, or religious structures that do exclude women. So putting them in place is one point, but action beyond that is the other point, and I think this was already raised at some point. The inclusion of provisions. The Maputo Protocol, I'll leave it at the Maputo Protocol, specifically addresses the patriarchal tradition and cultural institutions practices that hinder women's empowerment, and an issue raised by the concluding observations. So the issue of patriarchy and traditional practices. While the bill acknowledges patriarchy, it does have a limited resolve around patriarchy. An inclusion of the provision of the protocol would strengthen the commitment to gender equality of a scourge that impacts the majority of Southern African women. And we say that mainly because this particular protocol is designed for the African continent and the context of the African woman or women in Africa. And since South Africa has ratified the protocol, we encourage its inclusion under Section 3B of Objective of the Act, which also contributes to the domestication process of the protocol, so bringing in line South African legislative framework with international provisions that they have already ratified across the continent and internationally. The other issue to us would be the gender budgeting issue. While it's encouraging to note that there is confidence within the bill that there's not that, and I'm quoting, significant direct financial implications due to structures mentioned in the bill already being funded, as stated in Section 6.3. We would like to humbly submit that, in fact, gender budgeting continuously remains a challenge in developing equity measures, and in line with most of the legislation that's out there, financial implications do exist. So the statement seems rather firm. However, at the same time, we would like to differ on that point, and gender budgeting should be considered. Now, when it comes to terms of the definitions that have been used, and again, some of these have been mentioned, but I do believe it's worth emphasis. The definition of empowerment. The bill limits itself in defining the scope of empowerment, and therefore it's rather unclear on what issues are being addressed under the bill. There's social economic empowerment, yes, there's discrimination and gender mainstreaming are included. However, there's the issue of justice and access to justice as forms of empowerment. These were not necessarily spelled out directly under these provisions, and they exclude an issue that plays a big role in the lives of the majority of women in South Africa in terms of access to justice and also decision-making around justice. And this would bring in line the issue around the Muslim marriage bill, where it has been in discussion for 10 years plus, 12 years if I'm not mistaken. And the question is, who is engaging in that process, and are women in these communities also having say in them? Furthermore, this would be an opportune time for the ministry to take that up as an enforcement and a push towards the empowerment of these particular groups of women. Now, Section 9 reveals that the bill does not necessarily adopt an intersectional approach to discrimination. And by this, I'm talking about the inextricable link between the other factors that impact on women, the fact that we're not a homogeneous group of women, and the fact that they are compounding issues that different women would address at any one time is not necessarily addressed. It's quite linear in the provision that is set out in the bill at the moment, where it's either around training, around one particular issue or another, but the compounding or the multiplicity of the issues not necessarily dealt with in full. Now, in terms of the level of responsibility, this is in reference to Section 4. The issue also addresses the issue of the terminology used of designated public and designated private bodies. This suggests a challenge to the bill, which refers to the bill, as there's a limited or there's a narrow definition of these bodies. And by this, I'm talking again, it's not inclusive of religious bodies, it's not inclusive of traditional bodies or traditional structures that do exist, or local level structures that may be informal or formal. Not that we can necessarily enforce greatly on them, but there is something to be said about that. So the definition would rather broaden itself more widely. And in terms of responsibility directly, under Section 4.1, subsection A, the issue of women's childbearing responsibilities are addressed without the full scope of addressing, really, if we're talking about attrition of girls in school or women in school. We're not talking of the other issues that are doing, and it's not just about the childbearing responsibilities. There is the issue of gender roles that are assigned, so you then have child-headed households, or you have issues of bad toilets. Therefore, girls, you know, refrain from going to school during certain periods in their time, in their lives. Also, Section 1.4, subsections B and C, refer to the education and training of women towards the development for gender equality. Now, yes, it's important that women are empowered in that way, but structurally it's important to also have holistic empowerment of men and women in that regard, so that there is sustainability around understanding what gender equality is, and it doesn't become the problem of or the responsibility of women to address the issue of gender equality. So those are the main points, and a lot has been said. I think I just wanted to put in the main points that we felt needed to be highlighted at this moment. So our conclusion is that as the two organizations, we value and applaud the efforts being made by the ministry to address a complex social, economic, and social political issue in South Africa by introducing the bill. However, we hope that our written and oral submissions are closely considered an alternative approach or a revised bill through wider consultation and inclusivity of individuals and concepts is considered. As to us, that's important that it does not only consider reform of the bill, but consider an alternative approach to addressing the wider issue that we're trying to address. So we humbly thank you for giving us this opportunity, and especially in the present moment, and we hope that our opinions and values will take some critical measure in the efforts that are being made. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Certainly all the views and the opinions are going to be looked into, and you'll get the responses. Our next? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Question of clarity.
Yeah. It's the same question that I've asked to a previous person that submitted. My question is, do you think that this bill can be salvaged with amendments? Or do you think that the objectives of the bill can be realized through amendments of existing legislation? And you mentioned some of the existing legislation here: promotion of equality and prevention of unfair discrimination, Employment Equity Act. What is your opinion on that one? Thank you.
My opinion would really be to first consider looking at the alternative as opposed to a bill at this stage, which is closing the gaps that do exist within existing legislation first, and do that audit and address it from that perspective. Only then and at that point would it be clear to us whether another bill would be necessary, because it is true, South Africa is strong on legislation. It is just a question of the implementation processes, as well as the commitment of budget and such expertise towards reviewing and auditing, because of the mobile nature of legislation and social transition. So I'd rather that we halted for a minute, sought an auditing process and review before continuing with pushing for this bill at this moment. then it would be more clear what the mandate would be out coming out of it, what the bill would definitely look like, and what the focus of the bill would be at that time. But at this point, I'm feeling that it's not cohesive in the manner in which it's set out.
Okay, good afternoon, and apologies, Honorable Chairperson, for that slight delay. Business Unity South Africa would like to thank the Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee for allowing us the opportunity to come and engage you on our submission regarding this particular bill. And I also like to acknowledge and appreciate the presence of the Minister observing the hearings, because I think it does give the Minister an opportunity to hear at first hand some of the inputs and the comments that are coming from the various submissions. Just to indicate, without going into details because of the time constraints, but I'm sitting here representing all our members of Business Unity South Africa, and these are small, medium, and big companies that are operating in various sectors: transport, retail, engineering, manufacturing, mining, all of them. So I'm here representing all of them, and they have endorsed and mandated me to come and present the submission to you. Just to first put context on the process. And I think from Business Unity South Africa, I made an advantage because the bill was tabled at NEDLAC for negotiations, and we presented business as part of the deliberations of this particular bill at NEDLAC. I need to indicate categorically that we did convene a number of meetings on this particular bill, and many of the inputs and the comments that came out here this morning were some of the inputs and comments that we raised as constituencies at NEDLAC. And because of the inability of the department to explain the duplications that have been referred to and how the compliance will affect the existing legislation, and also to explain in clear, simple terms the rationale and for this particular piece of legislation, it therefore resulted in this particular bill be withdrawn from NEDLAC. And the decision was supported by all constituencies, business, labor, as in COSATU, NACTU, and FEDUSA, and community constituencies. So this was a decision of NEDLAC supported by all constituencies to withdraw the bill because of its vagueness, of its ambiguity, but also not being able to explain how compliance will work, and most particularly how enforcement will work. So I think I needed to put that into context, because I did hear some also comments around consultation, but I did need to indicate that there was some consultation at NEDLAC, but the bill was withdrawn. And it's unfortunate, because had we addressed many of the comments and the inputs that were discussed at NEDLEG, the committee would be sitting with a better looking bill that would have been received at least some support, because all of the comments that have been raised, we would have dealt with them at the level of NEDLEG. Unfortunately, that did not happen. I need to also indicate that, and this we alluded to in our comprehensive submission, that we do support the intent of the bill. However, we don't support the bill in its current form because of a number of reasons that I will allude to, and also many of the speakers have already indicated that. The first thing is that, you know, the objectives of the bill we understand, but the targets also are unclear, and for various reasons that have been articulated, including the duplication with existing related relevant legislation, such as PEPUDA, such as employment equity, and the BBBEE. And we feel that as companies, as businesses, what is required of us, it will be difficult to implement, and business will end up being penalized for not doing the impossible, if I were to put it like that. I think from business, where we're looking at this, and we also link it to the idea around the progressive realization of 50-50 percentage at the workplace. But our concern is that the assumption is that the women are there in the labor market, are there in terms of in companies, and therefore this woman should then have that 50% representation. But the reality is not in all sectors you will find that kind of representation, and for various reasons. It has to do with the choice of a particular person to enter into a particular field. I will share with you some statistics. A lot of them are covered in our submission. It tells you the kind of representation that we have in the labor market in terms of demographics, gender to be specific. You will see that there are certain professions that are woman-dominated, and there are certain professions that are male-dominated, and there are those professions that, you know, you do find some balance. And I think I would support the previous speaker who talked about investigating the factors why we do have such a pool in our labor market, but also understanding that if you are going to ask a mining company to have 50% of representation of women in their decision-making structures, you are assuming that within that industry you have a pool to draw from. But the reality is, hence you will find, for an example, 95% of engineers are not women. So a mining company will end up being penalized or will be penalized, of course, for not doing what is impossible. So therefore, there has to be a pool that we draw for. And we can only draw that pool out of post-school system. So at the level of universities, if you are not having female who are doing engineering, you're not going to have them in the workplace. I think that's where we're coming from. The other factor that we need to make very clear, and this was alluded to in many, many submissions, has to do with the issue of duplication with existing legislation. And I will not go into detail with this because I think many submissions or many presenters have really illustrated this in detail. But I think it is important here that we need to state that this bill does duplicate and it overrides this existing legislation. And just to also respond to the question by the Honourable Member about reviewing existing legislation, the reality of the matter is the employment equity have been amended and the President has signed it into Act. So that's another reality that we need to live with. For example, the BBBEE also has been amended and is now an Act. So I think reviewing existing legislation, as far as those are concerned, might be problematic because that process is complete. But I think we might want to investigate other ways of doing it. And I think the idea of doing a comprehensive research and investigate and do an audit of why we are struggling to implement existing legislation and what the department can do to support constituencies, to support business, to support all the other organizations in order to realize what this what the bill seeks to do, I think that's something that we need. It's more practical and will give us better results than having another piece of legislation that will be difficult to implement. I will also go specifically into, I think the last thing that we want to make also as business is that we've seen a number of legislation, and it's a fact that South Africa is quite an overly regulated labor market environment, and this has very negative impact on foreign direct investment, which we so need, especially if we were to promote or rather to provide the jobs that are required, particularly by our young people. So if we have legislation that is vague, that is ambiguous, that is not clear what, you know, who it's targeting. It gives a wrong impression to the investors, and it creates an impression that South Africa is a no-go area for investment, and we can't deal with that, we can't afford that. And bearing in mind that this foreign direct investment is limited, there are quite a number of competitors in this space, so we need to make sure that we provide a regulatory environment that enables these investors to come and invest in our country. Just to be specific, and this, some of these comments have already been made, application of the Act, I mean, as far as the bill is concerned, it's not clear who this bill will apply to. It talks about designated bodies, but these are not defined, and there's no criteria. The Speaker indicated earlier, there's no criteria in terms of who these designated bodies will be. So my members are saying, who is going to be responsible for complying with this bill? Who is this bill targeted at? It says designated bodies, but it doesn't explain which those bodies are or who those bodies are. Education and training, I need to reiterate this. There's reference on this particular section to international agreements that are not also specified. So at the end of the day, you are referred to international agreements that are not defined in the bill, which is very problematic as well. Issues of health and education, and I think I will support the point made, which is what we are also making in the by the second speaker, about the state not abdicating its responsibility to these bodies. The state has got a mandate, and the mandate is to do certain things. And as far as international agreements are concerned, it's very clear what state parties are responsible for. And I think the best that government can do is to work together with constituencies to achieve that and not say you do that, because there's no resources. As much as there's no resources within the government, there are no resources within companies to be able to do this. I think there has to be that clarity going forward. So there has to be, I think we'll support a process where there's partnership between government and business, and we together work on how we can achieve some of these things without necessarily it having a bill in place. Economic empowerment, I mean, PEPUDA, people have, not PEPUDA, the BEE, but also the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework does talk to promotion of public procurement for women-led or women-owned enterprises. Schedule 1 of the bill, it lists numerous legislation. When this was tabled at NEDLAC, we asked the department, what is the linkages between all these many legislation that you are listing with compliance with this particular bill? What is the relationship? How will compliance work? And unfortunately, we didn't receive the response, which is why you're still having many people asking the same question about duplication with other relevant legislation. And like I said, it remains also very difficult or unclear as to how issues such as compliance and enforcement will be dealt with this particular bill. And also stressing the fact that was made also earlier about the capacity, resource-wise, financial-wise, human capital-wise, of the department itself to be able to implement this bill comprehensively, follow it through, and make sure that everybody does what they're expected to do. In conclusion, Chair, I would like to reiterate that a number of the provisions of this bill remains very vague at this point and very ambiguous. And it also assumed the position of a super bill, where now it will supersede all the existing legislations that have been in place for many years. And we've seen some improvements with the Employment Equity Act, for an example. And the current amendment also extends the discriminatory portion of that particular act to make sure that there is no discrimination regardless of gender at the workplace. So we do feel that some of these things are already covered in existing legislation. Like I said, enforcement provisions are very weak and unclear, and the impact of these provisions will only result in uncertainty, will result in the number of litigation cases, will also increase administrative burden on businesses, because in order to comply with the bill as it is, section that deals with education, that deals with health, it requires you plans. You need to have capacity to be able to draw those plans already over and above the plans that we submit for EEA, the plans that we submit for BE. So there's quite a lot, and this will result in an extra administrative burden on businesses. And when businesses are burdened administratively, what do? They cut workers, because they cannot afford, the cost of employment becomes high, and it's not a situation that as a country we can afford. Lastly, like I said, and like many other people have said, this bill does face a lot of many shortcomings in its structure and also in its objectives, and therefore as BUSA, we are not in a position to support the bill in its current form. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Can I get members? Do you have any questions or clarity-seeking questions or comments? If not, let me thank you once more for your presentation, and we will have the next presentation from Justice Alive, South Africa. If you are ready, you will then proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and honourable members of the committee. And I respectfully greet the minister. It seems all wrong she should be sitting behind me, but I know that she understands. Now, I would like to make sure, because I can go much more quickly if this is the case, that the committee members all have a copy of the oral submission. I suspect they have copies of the written submission from the Justice Alliance. I want to be sure you have the amplified version of that, which is the oral submission. It should have been distributed this morning. Wonderful. It says oral submission at the top. The reason for that is that we are going to deal with a number of legal matters, and I know you won't want me to linger on those or to spell them out in detail, so I'm anxious you should have them in writing. And I have made sure that the state's legal advisor, Mr. Luke Hilton, has a copy. So the references to cases and the like are particularly for him. I want to say thank you for the opportunity. On behalf of the JASA board, we give you thanks for making this time for public submissions. JASA very much values those sections in our Constitution which provide for public participation in the lawmaking process, and we value the opportunity you're giving us today. Before expressing our concerns, may I assure the committee that JASA understands the motivation behind the bill and the need for it. You've asked, Madam Chairman, for clear and succinct conclusions, and you will find those at the end of the document. I will come to those at the end. Now, I want to begin by outlining why we are concerned, particularly about the definition of private body in Clause 1 of the bill, and more important, of major importance, Clause 2 of the bill. Because we say that Clause 2 goes to the question of whether this bill is constitutional or not. But let me outline very shortly why we're concerned about those things particularly. We're concerned that the power given to the minister to designate private bodies particularly, but also public bodies, is insufficiently defined in the bill, and therefore may be used to include private bodies of a religious nature, such as churches, private charitable bodies such as NPOs, and bodies perhaps of traditional community leaders. Any of those bodies, if they are juristic persons, are caught by Section 1, Clause 1, and I'll come to the definition of a private body. I'll come to that in just a moment. And the question of what rises, I think, is that really what the legislature wants? Do you want to catch all those bodies? Should they all be open to designation by the minister? We submit that religious bodies and churches, such as the Roman Catholic Church, which has already been mentioned as an example, which do not permit women in certain leadership roles for theological reasons, would suffer unlawful discrimination under, of course, Section 9 for the equality section, religion, conscience, and belief, and culture, but also Sections 15, 18, and 31 of the Constitution, freedom of religion, freedom of association, and Section 31, the protection of cultural, religious, and linguistic communities. We believe coming to charities, charities such as NPOs, which are staffed by voluntary workers, should not be compelled to comply with a 50% gender distribution. So often, and I know from experience, it is simply a question of finding who is available to offer time and talents at no charge. I'm a little out of my depth when it comes to traditional leaders of traditional cultural communities, but I know that more and more these bodies, such as the Eastern Cape House of Community Leaders, which I've had contact with for a particular reason recently, more and more of them are constituting themselves as juristic persons because they want to have the opportunity to sue or be sued in their own name. And they, of course, would object to the 50% women proportion on their controlling boards. And they would, therefore, too, be at risk of suffering unlawful discrimination of their constitutional rights under Sections 18 and 31 of the Constitution in particular. Now, coming specifically to Clause 1, the definition of a private body, churches and charities, and indeed traditional leaders too, do not carry on trade, business, or professions, and are therefore not caught by paragraphs A or B of the definition of a private body in Clause 1. However, some are juristic persons within subparagraph C in terms of their founding documents or constitutions. And therein lies our concern. And although it's not my task to ask questions, I ask rhetorically, why is subparagraph C included? Why does the legislature want to include juristic persons? There's no definition of a juristic person in the bill, so we turn to the law books. I think the most authoritative is probably Classen's Dictionary of Legal Words and Phrases, and I have put in the papers there the definition that is provided by that authoritative work. The all-important characteristic seems to be that they can sue and be sued in their own name. I just want to add one point there, which is not in my notes, which I have distributed. I just ask rhetorically the question, why should juristic persons be included and not trusts? The Supreme Court of Appeal in a case called Lappaccini against the Minister of Safety and Security in 2010 made it clear that trusts are not juristic persons. So trusts are excluded. If one constitutes one's private body as a trust, there's no question of being designated. If you constitute in some other way as a juristic person, then you are in at risk for being designated. It's a question of what the legislature wants, and it's not at all clear, we would submit, at the moment. But then I come to the much bigger issue in Clause 2. Clause 2, of course, is the root clause in the bill. And may I say, in layman's terms, that it should, we submit, be the hallmark of all good legislation that it is drafted in a simple and certain way which the public at large can understand. They must know to whom it applies. They then respect it and obey it. A lot has been said already about vagueness and uncertainty, and I want to respectfully underline that. It is submitted that Clause 2.2 and 2.3 delegate to the minister in office when the bill is passed, or any successor in the future, a right to designate public and private bodies without providing, I put in my notes, proper and adequate guidelines, without providing any guidelines as to the exercise of such a discretion. And we submit that that clause is unconstitutional. For the following reasons. The Constitutional Court refers to offending against the delegation constraints required by the Constitutional Court. That's a principle which they've laid down. Secondly, vagueness, another principle. Thirdly, the possibility of arbitrary use by a minister. Now, these things can be found in discussed at length in the leading textbook on constitutional law, and that's there for your law advisors, and I've given the references. The leading authorities, I've put in my notes four cases. First of all, the foundational case on the doctrine of delegation, which goes right back to 1995, the first year of the court, the Constitutional Court. Then the well-known case of Darwood against the Minister of Home Affairs, granting residence permits for foreign spouses. Let me just read, if I may, what Justice O'Regan said. She said, there is a difference between requiring a court or tribunal in exercising a discretion to interpret legislation in a manner that is consistent with the Constitution and conferring a broad discretion upon an official who may be quite untrained in law and constitutional interpretation and expecting that official, in the absence of direct guidance, to exercise the discretion in a manner consistent with the provisions of the Bill of Rights. And of course, one has to recognize that although the discretion is given to the minister, who may have particular skills even in the realm of law, she has to delegate, obviously, to her officials. And then the Affordable Medicines case, another well-known case, 2006. The court said this, the delegation must not be so broad or vague that the authority to whom the power is delegated is unable to determine the nature and scope of the powers conferred. For this may well lead to the arbitrary exercise of the delegated power. Where broad discretionary powers are confirmed, there must be some constraints on the exercise of such power so that those who are affected by the exercise of broad discretionary powers will know what is relevant to the exercise of those powers or in what circumstances they are entitled to seek relief from an adverse situation. As the last speaker said, it's very difficult for somebody running a small business. They have no idea whether they might be designated next week or not. And the court went on there. The doctrine of vagueness is founded on the rule of law, which, as pointed out earlier, is a foundational value of our constitutional democracy. It requires that laws must be written in a clear and accessible manner. What is required is reasonable certainty, not perfect lucidity. The doctrine of vagueness does not require absolute certainty of laws. The law must indicate with reasonable certainty to those who are bound by it what is required of them so that they may regulate their conduct accordingly. And of course, implicit there is the more basic issue, who is bound by it? Who is likely to be designated? It's quite unlawful that we should leave people asking that question without any way of answering it. And then there's a very recent case, of course, the Glenister case, with an interesting comment in the leading textbook, which I cited earlier. This is a 2011 case. The writers say the thought process of the Glenister majority of justices, suggests that the court might be more open to complaints about the lack of guidelines for delegated lawmaking, not only when rights are directly at stake, as in Darwood, but also when the independence of an institution is threatened. Certainly, dealing with the types of bodies which I have mentioned, rights are directly at stake, we would say, and certainly the independence of these smaller institutions is threatened if Parliament uses the big stick to try and get them into line. And so I conclude. You asked for succinct conclusions. One, we submit that Clause 2 of the bill is unconstitutional and must be redrafted so that both public and private bodies know exactly what criteria will be applied in deciding whether or not to designate them. Two, we submit that one of the following alternatives should be adopted to rectify the definition in Clause 1 of the bill. Either subparagraph C of the definition of a private body in Clause 1 should be deleted, that's taking out the juristic person, or a fourth subsection should be added somewhere, perhaps Clause 2, which says the minister shall not have power to designate any private body of a religious, charitable, or traditional leadership nature. I'm very happy to take questions. Thank you for the opportunity to address you.
Thank you very much for your concise and brief presentation. Honourable members, Any questions? They don't seem to have any questions. Thank you very much for your presentation. And
thank you, Madam Chair, very much.
Shall now have a Court for Justice.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Honourable Members, the Honourable Minister and her staff. We appreciate the opportunity to address you today. Just to give you a quick introduction to Cause for Justice, the organisation, it's a human rights organisation called into existence for the purpose to advance constitutional justice in South Africa, primarily through litigation, creating public awareness and participation in the legislative process, as well as governmental decision-making structures. The vision of Cause for Justice is the establishment and preservation of a South African society in which justice is dispensed to all through the protection and promotion of constitutional rights and freedoms of each member of society. Along with its mission and vision, the following core values of Cause for Justice gives it a particular interest in the bill. Firstly, a stable family unit is the cornerstone of healthy, well-functioning communities and society at large. Each human life carries equal value and everyone is entitled to equal protection and benefit of the law. Every person has the right to freedom of conscience, religion and opinion, freedom of expression and freedom of association. Then just as a further introduction, we became aware of the current process and these hearings at a very late stage, within the last 2 weeks, which means that we actually did not consider the legislation contained in Schedule 1 to the bill. Being that as it is, we believe that our submissions still carry weight and is relevant for the reason that we are focusing on constitutional principles which apply across the board to any legislation or proposed legislation. We also want to note that these submissions are not intended to be exhaustive. The purpose is to focus on what to us are the most pertinent matters that require further consideration and debate. Firstly, we want to commend the Minister and her department for taking up their mandate and for carrying out with dedication. We believe that any action taken to empower the vulnerable and to work towards true gender equality is a step taken from the right starting point. Our first submission, and there are five of them, is regarding the interaction with existing legislation and the need for the bill. This goes to the point that has been raised on numerous occasions today about duplication. And we say that the critical question for Parliament is to consider if and the extent to which the bill overlaps with existing legislation that has been enacted to empower the disadvantaged and to promote equality. So we say the bill first has to pass the test of redundancy. Also has to be borne in mind that the existing Acts of Parliament, which are focused on equality, are being implemented at great cost to South Africans, the taxpaying public, who foots the bill in order that our laws may be given effect to. If by enacting the bill, government will end up being the chief beneficiary, either by growing its human resources or increasing its budgetary demand, or both of them, the bill cannot be supported. We looked at the objects of the bill, which says that it carries forward the constitutional vision of equality by requiring the development and implementation of plans and measures to redress gender imbalances. We're saying that without providing the public with clear current statistics regarding gender imbalances at the present time, it's very difficult for the public to decide and make an informed decision whether to support the bill or not. We're saying that if imbalances are limited to specific geographical areas or are mainly the result of unemployment or living standard measure profiles, then the bill in its current form, which has a national and a broad scope, may be unnecessary or even unwanted. We therefore invite the department to provide the public and parliament with the necessary statistics to make an informed decision about whether to support the bill or not. Our second submission is around designation. It has been touched upon by the previous speaker as well. We're saying that the bill imposes burdensome obligations on public and private bodies, which we refer to as bodies further in our submission. We say that bodies should therefore be allowed to opt out or dispute their designation based on their existing policies, measures, and statistics regarding the promotion of women empowerment and gender equality within their organizations. We propose that the designation process, that a designation process should be drafted into the bill to provide for identification of bodies that are not yet promoting women empowerment and gender equality. This could be done by including an initial assessment form that needs to be completed, or requiring a body to submit a report of its existing policies, measures, and gender demographic statistics. Bodies should also be allowed to request reasons for their designation, and the department should be obliged to answer those. Then our third submission is about health, and specifically reproductive health. We read from the Bill Clause 5.1, bodies must develop and implement models for delivering women's health, including reproductive health, in order to achieve the progressive realization of access to health and reproductive rights for women in compliance with the applicable legislation and international agreements. We're saying that the terms reproductive health and reproductive rights are unclear and must be defined to enable bodies to know what they are dealing with. To the extent that these terms refer to contraception and more problematically to abortion, there is a risk that Clause 5.1 is unconstitutional to such extent. The interaction with the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Act would be crucial to the question of constitutionality. There are bodies in South Africa, of which cause for justice is but one, who affirm the sanctity of human life and hold the view that to terminate a pregnancy prematurely or unnaturally is to end a human life. Bodies who oppose abortion on demand do so based on deeply held beliefs and convictions, which in some instances may be based in religion. To force such bodies to facilitate or pay for their employees, or in the case of medical aid schemes, to pay for their fund managers to abort their children, would infringe upon their constitutional right to freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief and opinion, and the right to freedom of association. Although these bodies may not physically restrain women from aborting their children, they may not be forced to be part of something that offends against their convictions. These bodies may, however, be inclined to provide it for the termination of an employee or fund member's pregnancy where medical opinion indicates that both mother and child will die, and that termination of the pregnancy will allow at least the mother to live. Hence the importance of establishing a clear link with the detailed provisions of the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Act, if Clause 5 is to be persisted with at all. We propose that Clause 5 should be redrafted to provide protection for bodies' rights to freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief and opinion, and the right to freedom of association, and Cause for Justice is willing to assist in such redrafting process. We note that South Africa should avoid the situation currently experienced in the United States of America, where litigation is abounding on the infringement of employers' rights to freedom of conscience and religion by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which is also called Obamacare. Then our fourth submission is around formal or substantive gender equality, and with formal gender equality we refer to equal treatment. Substantive gender equality, as been mentioned before, refers to equal outcomes. We said that the bill contains a number of references to substantive equality. We propose that the South African people and therefore Parliament should debate the issue of gender equality and whether the nation agrees that both formal and substantive gender equality should be legislated. Cause for Justice is of the view that formal gender equality, i.e. striving to treat all people equally and enabling them to exercise choices on an equal basis, is a constitutional aspiration and imperative. However, to legislate substantive gender equality is to divorce equality from reality and from human dignity. To impose an arbitrary percentage, 50% or any other percentage, is to force choices onto people, thereby preventing them from making their own free choices and consequently infringing upon their right to human dignity. We use an example of a fictitious body A who wants to act in the best interest of the business it operates and therefore in the best interest of its employees. It determines to grow the business as quickly and sustainably as possible, which includes continually growing its workforce to alleviate unemployment and poverty in South Africa. It goes through a robust process and determines that to achieve their goals, they must appoint candidates that are best qualified and best suited for each role within the body. The body determines to make no distinction based on race, gender, disability, or any other ground, and record their employment policy in writing. When the body invites candidates to apply for vacancies, they implement the employment policy faithfully. Candidates who apply for positions in the body know that if they are appointed, they truly are the best suited for the position and are therefore affirmed in their human dignity. Because the body does not discriminate based on gender, the gender demographics within the body fluctuate continually. All candidates are treated equally because the criteria used to determine their appointment gives each one an equal opportunity. To force such a body to maintain a 50% or any other percentage gender split would not only infringe on its own right to freedom of association, but it would also infringe on both male and female candidates' rights to human dignity and equal treatment. We then go on to a specific individual choice. We say that assuming that body A invites or has vacancies up to 20 positions, and assuming that the people of South Africa accept that gender equality should be legislated, then we say that in terms of the bill, they have to appoint at least 10 women in respect of these 20 vacancies. Now we say that a scenario could play itself out where the application is open to all people. The body receives 100 applications, of which 10 are women. Then we say clearly women exercising their right to choose based on human dignity have indicated that 1 in 10 or 10% representation would satisfy the requirement of substantive equality. If the body were to disregard this clear indication and appoint all 10 female applicants, its action would be substantively unequal and would be disrespecting the choice and human dignity of the women who have freely indicated their preference to be appointed in the available positions. Of course, the converse scenario may also happen where you have 90 female applications. In that case, a 50% representation would also be completely inadequate to provide for substantive equality. We accordingly submit that measures to promote gender equality that do not take into account people's free choice in respect of their employment would both be unconstitutional and irrational. An unqualified percentage, 50% or any other, that government attempts to force onto people would be arbitrary as it could not have any rational base. We then refer also to prevailing cultural choices, where we say that people's cultural choices play an undeniable role in their employment choices and their choices about the associations they make. People who come from or prescribe to a specific family culture or belong to a religious community, for example, may choose as a general norm for mothers to be homemakers and to take responsibility for the day-to-day care of children. Their choices may be based on deeply held beliefs regarding the general roles that are most beneficial for family and for society as a whole. If people exercise their life choices in this manner, which would result in a lesser percentage of women wanting to and being able to apply for appointments to bodies, the state and the law should respect the cultural choices of its citizens. Also in this scenario, 50% or any other percentage the government attempts to impose on people would be arbitrary as it would be divorced from the basis of a rational percentage. We accordingly propose that the current 50% requirement be replaced with an alternative measure or measures or a measuring stick to promote equal treatment of women in bodies. The measures taken by the fictitious body A may be a helpful starting point in this regard. The proposed pre-designation process we've highlighted earlier will then ensure that bodies that are already promoting women empowerment and general gender equality are screened out through the proposed assessment process. We have a number of short, specific submissions regarding specific clauses, and I would like to refer to clause 11.1. Subclause B, we regret the focus in subclause B on distinguishing between men and women in respect of land ownership. It is our view that the general focus should be not be on the individual, but rather on families and promoting the family. In respect of clause 2012, we invited the department to provide the public and parliament with research facts indicating that women with disabilities are currently worse off than men with disabilities. If this is not factually the case, promoting an economic empowerment of women only, in other words, at the exclusion of men with disabilities, is likely to amount to unfair discrimination. In respect of Clause 15 and 16, we submit that the Minister's enforcement powers should be clearly defined and confined to mechanisms appropriate to the field of equality, for example, referral to the Human Rights Commission and or the Equality Court. We submit that a clause or clauses should be added containing the maximum penalties to which individuals that are responsible for the implementation of the bill could be subjected, and such maximum penalties should not include the possibility of a prison sentence. Finally, or second to last, in respect of clauses 17 and 18, we submit that the code of good conduct and frameworks referred to in those clauses should be published prior to the enactment of the bill and must be published only after a proper public participation process. To publish these instruments only after the law has passed through Parliament would place bodies in a prejudiced position, as they would have compliance obligations without knowing what to aim for and where the process is headed. We submit that such a situation would be untenable. Our final submissions regarding a sunset clause, we propose that consideration should be given to including a sunset clause into the bill. In other words, a date by which the proposed affirmative action will cease and the people of South Africa be allowed to freely choose the nature and level of their economic activity or inactivity. Just the committee finds our submissions helpful, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I see two hands there. Honorable Member Ake and Honorable Member Mori.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair. And we want to thank the presenter. It's not a question, but to ask for your presentation, your submission, because in the package that you are having, there's nothing. So
okay.
We request a written submission.
Yes, I think I sent it through a little late. It was only on Monday, and I apologize for that. But I believe it will be available to the committee.
Okay. I just want to inquire, what is your opinion on the existing legislation being implemented, monitored, and assessed to determine outcomes? Do you think this bill, you know, will help empower women, and do you think it will bring equality?
Thank you for the question. Unfortunately, as I mentioned in my introduction, because of a very tight time schedule, we were not able to actually consider all the legislation that are already in place in the field of equality and empowerment. So it makes it a little difficult to answer your question, and if the committee permits, I prefer not to just throw out a wild opinion at this stage.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for your presentation. Can we then proceed to Joshua Generation Church? Are you here?
Yes, I am here.
No, it's not. That is not in your to do that. You can come and sit here. The committee can do that. You are usurping our job. If you are ready, we can proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Chair, members of the committee, Honourable Minister, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you on the Wedgie Bill today. As appears on the programme, my name is indeed Ms. Bardnort. However, the organisation that I'm representing today is is not Joshua Generation Church. Joshua Generation Church merely acted as the correspondent office for another organization who I am indeed representing here today, and that organization is called 4SA. It is spelled F-O-R-S-A. It stands for Freedom of Religion in South Africa, but I will return to exactly who that organization is, who the constituency is, what the mandate is in a moment. If I may just ask you to formally note that the party in front of you, the organization in front of you today, is indeed 4SA. Madam Chair, our time is limited. I will try my utmost to be to the point as possible. For this reason and for your benefit, I have prepared full comprehensive submissions, which I've already taken the liberty of handing out, but which I now formally request that you also take those into account. The shortest submission that was submitted on an earlier occasion was prepared under time constraints, but as I say, it is for your benefit. And in order to elucidate any questions that may arise or to really follow the train of thought, I have for your benefit prepared the written submissions, and I do ask that those be taken account of. At the outset, Madam Chair, I want to state that I realize that this piece of legislation, this bill, is a culmination of a long process, many hours, great effort, sweat, blood, and tears to bring it to this point. And I do, at the outset, want to commend the committee, the commission, for the good intent, for the good objectives, the good aims in this bill, in really recognizing the role of women in society as agents of change, as transformation agents that can really make a difference in our society. However, if you will allow me the opportunity over the next few minutes to bring just one or two concerns that we have as 4SA regarding this bill to your attention, and also to offer to you recommendations, solutions, very specific wording, which I propose to you with very little effort and literally a few words may avoid or eliminate those concerns which at this stage may very well open up the bill to a constitutional challenge. If we may then move on from there, and you will allow me to briefly just introduce you to 4SA, and I'm referring to page one of the written submissions. 4SA, as I have already said, is an acronym that stands for Freedom of Religion in South Africa, and it is really a forum of different churches in South Africa, which forum is currently in the process of being registered and incorporated as a non-profit company in terms of the Companies Act. Recently, the forum was able to rally the support of church leaders representing 12 million citizens in South Africa on another issue relating to religious freedom. And 4SA is confident that once established, once incorporated, that its membership total will equal, if not exceed, that very number. Now, what then is the mandate of 4SA? Well, the mandate of 4SA is to be a voice for freedom of religion, for freedom of religious expression, for freedom of association and the rights of religious communities in South Africa, all of which, I do not need to remind you, are fundamental human rights entrenched in our constitution and which the state, and thereby include the legislature, is therefore enjoined to respect, protect, and promote. May I mention that although a Christian initiative, 4SA's overall mission is not to advocate Christianity or a specific religion or a specific theology. Rather, the mission is to protect freedom of religion as a right and as a freedom in our constitution. Therefore, the organization, as I would assume all of us are here today, and even so the draftment of the constitution or of this particular bill, we pro-choice. We are pro-laws and legislation that allow individuals, as the constitutional court has said, the right to entertain such religious beliefs as a person chooses, the right to declare such religious beliefs openly without fear of hindrance and reprisal, the right to manifest religious beliefs by worship and practice or by teaching and dissemination. That, in short, is the mandate of 4SA. The next question then, turning to page two of the formal submissions, what then is 4SA's interest in the gender bill before us today? Well, given that 4SA is really an organization that has been established to protect and promote religious freedom in South Africa, we concern ourselves with matters and with legislation that threaten those religious rights, and in particular also the institutional aspect of the right to religious freedom that is guaranteed by the cluster of religious rights in the Constitution. I do not need to refer you to the specific sections in the Act, in the Bill, of which you will be well aware. But particularly referring to Section 2 of the Bill relating to application of the Bill, read together with Section 1 of the Bill, the definition of private body, which specifically includes in its scope any juristic person but excludes a public body. Our submission is that within the scope of that definition, it is wide enough to include churches, to include also other religious or non-profit or charitable organizations. And our respectful submission, Madam Chair, is that that should not be so. In the name of freedom of religion, that the churches, religious organizations, charitable organizations should be specifically exempted from the Act for reasons which I will explain to you in a minute. And as I said, I will also offer to you the very specific recommendation, specific wording, how with very little effort, much can be done to avoid a constitutional challenge. What then are 4SA's concerns regarding the bill? Madam Chair, at the outset, I want to make it very clear to this assembly here today and to the committee that as an organization, 4SA is 100% for women. I wouldn't be part of an organization that stands for anything less than an organization that absolutely values, treasures the inherent dignity, the value, the capabilities of women equal to that of their male counterparts, and which are therefore equally worthy of respect, protection, and promotion. And again, therefore, 4SA commends the intent of the bill, we commend the objectives of the bill, we support the upliftment and empowerment of women that the bill sets out to achieve. We do, however, have two primary concerns regarding the bill in its current form. Namely, as has also been mentioned by some of the other speakers here today, the broad, very broad, overboard powers given to the minister in terms of the Act, and secondly, the bill's infringement on other constitutional rights. If we then turn on page 5 to the broad powers to the minister, I will not spend a lot of time there. I believe the speakers before me in particular, JASA also has said a lot about the broad powers given to the minister. Likewise, our concern is that the minister is given very broad powers, firstly to designate who the Act specifically will apply to, and in its current form, it includes churches, religious organizations, whether in the form of a non-profit company or just a voluntary association. And secondly, we are concerned about the very broad powers given to the minister to enforce compliance. Not only are these powers and the discretion very wide, but they are vague. They are open for arbitrary use by the minister, and on this basis, we believe, open for constitutional challenge. I will not linger on this point any longer. What I do want us to focus on in the next few minutes is the bill's infringement of other constitutional rights, which really for us is a real and a serious concern. You will just bear with me a moment. Clearly what we have here in the bill is a conflict of rights. On the one hand, we have the right of non-discrimination against women, which is specifically aimed at allowing women to take up leadership roles in society, different levels of society. But on the other hand, what it is in conflict with is the rights potentially, well, the rights definitely, of other women who perhaps choose not to pursue leadership callings, but who rather choose to submit, for instance, to a calling at home, to be a homemaker, or closer to home in our context, in the context of a church, not to take up leadership roles in churches, but to submit to the leadership of men as prescribed by the Holy Scriptures, and I will come to that in a moment. There is further the clash not only between the rights of women, Section 9 of the Constitution, the right to equality, but the right, a direct clash also with the rights to religious freedom, which, as I've already said, pertains to the right to freedom of religion, freedom of religious expression, freedom of association, as well as the rights to religious communities specifically entrenched in the Constitution, and which together our Constitutional Court has recognized give religious organizations a degree of autonomy and a degree to run their affairs, internal affairs, without interference by the state. That is the institutional aspect of the right to freedom of religion. Now, what do we do with this conflict of rights? We know, looking at the way that the courts, our Constitutional Court in particular, approaches these questions, these vexed questions, is it involves a balancing of rights, which often is done in terms of Section 36 of the Constitution. However, when it comes to a conflict with religious rights, which is no easy task. And for that very reason, our courts have tread very lightly to in fact do this, to achieve this exercise under Section 36. Instead, what they've preferred to do is to restrict the scope of the rights, and only in instances where it appears that the right which is sought to be protected, namely religion rights in this context, may appear harmful in that particular context. But then also depending on whether the belief relied upon impacts in fact, forms part of the religious doctrine or practices of the person concerned or is a central tenet of the person's religion. Now, Madam Chair, in the present context, two central beliefs, two central tenets of the Christian faith in particular are threatened or undermined by the bill. Namely, one, it is a central tenet of the Christian faith that the husband is the head of the home, as Christ is the head of the church. And that is specifically stated in the Holy Scriptures in Ephesians 5, verse 23. Furthermore, and as an extension of that, as it is stated that the husband is the head of the home, it is a central tenet not only of the Roman Catholic Church, but also of many Protestant churches hold to the belief that as the husband is the head of the home, so headship of the church as Christ's spiritual home is reserved for men. And this, in fact, this belief forms part of, is a central part of religious doctrine and practices, and this is also what is stated in 1 Timothy 2, verse 12, part of the Holy Scriptures. Madam Chair, if the bill were to be promulgated in its current form, it will have the following dire consequences. Firstly, the state, that is the legislature, will, number one, be undermining pluralism and diversity as a core value of our constitution. As you know, neither the constitution nor Papuda require uniformity in order to bring about equality. What they require is equal concern, equal respect. Secondly, by seeking to legislate values based on its value system and interpretation of Holy Scripture, in so doing, the state will effectively be dictating, on the grounds of gender, what people should believe or not to believe, which really amounts to a degree of thought control, which is a very dangerous situation and can never be justified. And this is a statement which has also been made by a constitutional court. You can find the authority for that in the written submissions. And what is even of greater concern is thereby would interfere with the individual's freedom of choice, which in itself is a core value of our constitutional democracy. Thirdly, by interfering with the autonomy of religious organizations guaranteed to them by the Constitution to govern their own affairs, as well as to teach and give practical expression to their beliefs according to the interpretation of Holy Scripture, that is the third effect that this bill could potentially have. Let's bring it more practical. As a further practical consequence, Madam Chair, women who themselves hold to the aforesaid beliefs and who are part of churches, who are part of religious organizations, who adhere, practice, and teach these beliefs, will be forced, against their free will, against their conviction, to take up leadership positions in decision-making structures of the church and organization. And I want to pause here to explain that, of course, if there are women who feel that this should not be the case in the church, they are very free not to join a church at all, or on the other hand, to go to a church who holds beliefs that are contrary to that, whose theology and who have a different theological perspective on the issue, and who do embrace diversity, women and men in eldership positions. But what we are saying is give the freedom of choice to those institutions who do hold, according to their interpretation of Holy Scriptures, to a certain theological perspective. Secondly, churches and or religious organizations who adhere, teach, and practice the aforesaid beliefs themselves will be forced to choose between, on the one hand, their faith, and on the other hand, respect for the law, with potentially very harsh consequences should they choose, in fact, to adhere rather their faith than the law, a situation which clearly should be avoided as far as possible in an open and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom. Madam Chair, I want to conclude by saying as a result of all these matters, we believe that the bill in its current form is likely to contract a constitutional challenge, which will be, we know, time-consuming, costly, indeed very unfortunate given the good intents, the good motivations, the good objectives that this act has in mind. I want to move forward and propose to you recommendations as to how this possibility of a constitutional challenge can be avoided or eliminated. And as I said, this can actually be done with very little effort. With very little effort, these presumably unintended, but nonetheless unconstitutional consequences of the bill in its current form can be avoided. And we submit that this can be done by simply inserting in the definition of private bodies in Section 1 of the bill, particularly subparagraph C, where it says private bodies including juristic persons, but excluding public bodies, just a number of words after that, namely any juristic person, but excludes a public body and any religious or charitable organization. So it's just a few words that need to be inserted after that, and that would exempt churches, religious organizations, charitable organizations from the very wide, overbroad application of the Act. And then furthermore, what we also recommend is that Section 14.2, read with Section 16 of the Bill, pertaining to enforcement, that it be amended expressly to set out what exactly are these dispute resolution mechanisms that will apply and the steps to be employed by the minister to compel compliance so as to avoid any confusion in this regard. Madam Chair, I want to conclude by stating that our Constitution protects, and you would all agree with me, that our Constitution protects freedom of religion. And we appeal to you, we implore you, not to pass legislation which instead will serve to bring about freedom from religion, which is not a core value of our Constitution, which does not embrace the diversity, the pluralistic nature of our democratic society, and thereby undermining and thereby destroying really one of the hallmarks of an open and free society. We appreciate that what you're trying to do here on the one hand is to gain territory for a particular constitutional right, the right of women, the right to equality. But in the process, if we don't tread carefully, we may lose other constitutional freedoms, which we treasure as part of our open and democratic society. As our constitutional court has often said, in our constitutional state, we do not see diversity as a necessary evil, but we see it as a treasure to be embraced. And I ask you, I urge you, Madam Chair, that we do that when in our consideration of the bill and the way going forward. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Ms. Badenhorst, for your presentation. Are we having any questions from the members? There are no questions.
Thank you
so much. And we will take the last presentation before lunch, which is Swaranang Legal Advocacy Center.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the committee for this opportunity. My name is Shireen Motara, and I'm from an organization called Swaranang Legal Advocacy Center to End Violence Against Women. We've been working in the area of violence against women and girls since 1997. What I propose to do is that I don't really want to repeat what others have said, because in essence we agree with most of what has been said, except for the previous three colleagues. That's not necessarily our contention. But we do agree with a lot of what has been said in terms of how to strengthen the bill and how to strengthen responses in terms of addressing women's empowerment and gender equality. What I do want to do is perhaps raise three key points, and with that, use some illustration from a short survey that we did in terms of the key issues that emerged, and perhaps raise some questions for the committee to consider in terms of deliberating around the bill. So the first thing for us was around, we get a sense is that there's a desperation from women for an effective mechanism to address inequality and marginalization. And when we did the survey, it was an online survey, so clearly it was not representative, but we had a fairly good group of women from across 8 provinces who responded. And the key thing that emerged from there was that 71% of them feel government is not responding to their challenges. And key things that they raised around that was a major one was poor implementation of the law. So there's a sense that we have good laws, but we're not implementing them. The other was this inequality that women have, which is exacerbated by, you know, where you live, what level of education you have, whether you're employed or not. The other was around the, what they call the hoops and hurdles to gain access to funds. So if women are to be economically free or be able to have, to live a good life, they don't have the access to the kind of economic opportunities that supposedly exist. And a major thing was that reported crime is not being followed up. So again, we have the laws, but we're not having action. Related to that, of the survey, what we found that was that 96% of those who responded to this question felt that this law was necessary. And our view is that there's a link with the previous point, which is that there's really a desperation for there to be some kind of effective solution to this problem of the serious marginalization of women in South Africa. And also they said that they believe the law is necessary. Some of the things they said were important was, if the law is in place, it could hold government accountable and improve the lives of women and children. I mean, that's not new, we know that. It could bring about a balanced society, but we lack implementation. Laws won't make a difference. We need a change in attitudes and beliefs. And we could create better opportunities for women if this law works. So what we are asking the committee to think about is, will this bill address those needs? And the second thing is this bill the effective mechanism that is required if we take into account our current legal framework and the extent to which we are having serious challenges with implementation? Our second point is around addressing the drivers of women's empowerment and marginalization. So some of the key things that emerged here was around 71% raised concerns around gender-based violence, safety and security, access to justice. And that has far-reaching implications. It could have implications for women's access to economic opportunities, to employment, to the safety of their children. 33% raised the issues around lack of access to economic opportunities. And what we do know is that where women don't have access to economic opportunities, to decent employment, the fact is that they will not get out of poverty. A key thing that emerged, which we find is not really addressed in the bill, is around single parenting. We have a society where a majority of parents are single mothers, and the extent to which this bill is responding to their challenges, we're not sure about. And discrimination in the workplace. So whilst there's been the Employment Equity Act since 1998, the extent to which there has been transformational change in the workplace for women is highly questionable. So the question that we'd like the committee to consider is the bill an answer to single mothers who suffer multiple levels of disempowerment and marginalization? Will the provision of economic empowerment and 50% quotas result in substantive improvement, since BEE frameworks and the Employment Equity Act have not achieved this? And addressing gender-based violence and access to justice is not a reality for most women in this country, despite all the laws that we have. So how will this bill change that? The key question that we have for the committee around this is, how will this bill change the situation if it has no enforcement mechanism? In fact, will it bring respite to a teenage single mom in the rural Eastern Cape, for example? Will her situation change drastically? Will her situation improve substantively? will it take women out of the survivalist economy? Because that is where women are located. And will this legislation address that? Is this bill responding substantively to the drivers of inequality that is ingrained not only in our laws, but in our society, in our systems, in our structures, in our practices, in our people? Will this bill be able to address that? Our final point is around this question of which many people have raised, the implementation of laws in this country. So we have a fairly good legal framework. We have fairly good laws in place that have really gone quite a way in terms of improving women's rights, protecting women's rights, but the implementation is falling short. And what we picked up from the survey also is that the common thread of concern is around the poor implementation of laws in this country. And there are numerous reasons for it that we know about. In general, the point is about duty bearers being unaccountable, being insensitive, lacking commitment to gender equality, and on the other hand, insufficient resources being allocated and insufficient infrastructure also being a problem. So we're asking the question in light of that concern around general poor implementation of laws is how will this law be different? How will the implementation of this law be different? And our concern with that is also that if other laws are subservient to this law, then it may have the impact of weakening existing laws which have some enforcement mechanisms. And I think that's an important thing that we need to think about. The other point is about who are the duty bearers in this legislation and how will they be held accountable. So for us, related to the enforcement, that is a big question. So in conclusion, one of the questions we asked was how should South Africa as a country address women's empowerment and gender equality? And one of the responses was creating more access to women as they tend to be more breadwinners than men. And really our fundamental question is, will this bill respond substantively to issues like that?
Thank you very much, Ms. Motara, for your presentation. Can I hear from members if there are any questions of clarity, and if there are none, we are going to be breaking for lunch. Thank you very much for your presentations. We will continue after lunch until 3:30.
Lunch is 1 hour,
so we should be back. Okay, we should be back by 2:30. Sorry for my watch sheet. I was not always behind. Thank you very much. We shall then reconvene at 2:30.
I can't leave, man. No, no, it's fine. It's fine. Keegan has already left.
Thank you.